Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of Globalize Asian. This week's episode touches upon the work and life of Shubha Rao. She is a business psychologist, and through her organization, The Shift Collective, are helping SMEs with objectives of social reform. She is an LSE alumnus with an extensive volunteering experience and working with people to support several behavioral and developmental concerns. Shubha's undying passion to make a real difference in the society is admirable. Thank you, Shubha, for joining us today. It's quite interesting what you're working on at the moment, and I understand there is a pool of talent you have, or the team you have, who have wealth of experiences. They've been entrepreneurs or professionals in their own niche. You've come all together and created this organization called The Shift Collective.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you tell us about that, please?
The principal objective of The Shift Collective is to support and help small organizations with a social mission. So they could be a social enterprise, they could be a charity, they could be a startup, but the principal focus is social change. And the reason why we're focusing on social change is because there are enough corporations, there are enough business-focused organizations. So what society really needs is organizations that can promote change in society among people, because we need that. So that's what we do.
Any examples of the current work you've done or organizations you've supported?
Essentially, right now, I've done a couple of projects with learning organizations, and these were essentially funding applications, helping them with funding and so on. Another organization I've worked with is they had an issue with the governance of the organization. So it was about mediation and helping them unpick what was going on and how to make it more easy for the organization to move forward. So there was actually an obstacle, a conflict in the governance team. So those are the two. The other one that I'm working on right now is merging art and culture and community safety. So this is a major project that we are looking at the moment. Okay. So we'll see how that goes.
So it's not just a social enterprise aspect of an organization. It's anything and everything for a startup, whether they're talking about marketing aspect of it, funding aspect of it, governance aspect of it.
Yeah.
And then, but the companies that you're choosing or the companies that you are interested in should have a social message.
Absolutely.
Or a focus.
Absolutely.
Around it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So there's, yes, so there's HR, there is administration, there is governance, there's structure, there's workflow processes. So we look at the whole organization.
How did you actually get into this field or area of work, Shubha? Tell us a little bit more about where you started, what your background is, and what brings you to what you're doing today?
Long journey. So I have an organizational psychology background. And when I came here, obviously, this is in late 80s. And Britain at that time wasn't yet sort of welcoming of Asian, Indian people. Mm-hmm. Unless, of course, I had a PhD, which I didn't have. So my master's degree was, it was recognized, but I couldn't work within the commercial sector. I'd have to sort of retrain and sort of thing. So I moved into mental health because that was an easier foray for me to go into that career. And I was working within the charitable sector with mind and mental health. And at the same time, I realized that, okay, I understand how corporations work. I understand how businesses work. Not the business side of it, but the people side of it. And I didn't really understand how the charitable organizations and the NGOs worked within the Western concept, Western context. So at that time, LSE had, it is the founding institution for welfare and charitable organizations and so on. So they had this amazing master's degree, which was called Management of Voluntary Sector Organizations, I think it is. And I applied and I got a scholarship to study that. And so I went ahead And then I went on to teach psychotherapy and counseling, and then I worked with black and white teams at the Tavistock. So again, it is within psychology that I had my footing, and within organizations, various organizations.
So that was more of a within corporate space rather than one-to-one within individuals.
Oh, it is one-to-one too. When I was working in mental health, for example, extensive one-to-one work with a whole range of people, from people who experience suicidal feelings to bipolar disorder and so on. So it's very, very intensive one-to-one work, very, very intensive group work, and also very intensive, it's called group dynamics work, between understanding how white and black relationships exist, what happens within the wider societal context.
You're talking about race here, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, race, color, sex, gender.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I worked on groups, I worked with individuals.
Interesting. And what about the Asians? Where do they fall?
Well, politically, if you look at it, Asians are viewed, I know in the US it's very different, but in the UK.
Southeast Asians.
In the UK, it's Asians are classified, as in brown Asians are classified as black, really.
Oh, really?
I mean, if you look at it from a political point of view, because it's about how society reacts to you. They either see you as white or not white.
Right.
So white or black. Yeah. And it's how society and people respond to you with that dynamic within that.
So what was the aim of these workshops? Was it to neutralize the effect of these divide within the society, or was it just to understand if somebody is going through a certain issue within their life, to educate them in any way? I mean, I'm just trying to understand these workshops that you had. What was the end goal for that?
There were various end goals. So when I was working on a one-to-one level, it is more immediate kind of experiences. What is happening in your workplace, or what is happening in a relationship. With groups, again, it was understanding how you as a member of a group, what kind of dynamic you have with other people. And then the bigger picture then is, how does that extend to society? How does that extend in group behavior, as society as a whole? How do mass behavior, how does it impact race? How does it impact women? So it's at all levels, because when there's an individual understanding of, say, a problem, or not even a problem, just an understanding and awareness, because somewhere along the line, as you live your life, it falls into place, and you say, so that's what's happening now.
And kind of where we are right now in terms of the political scenario across the world, and how that's informing social reforms, how prominent do you think your role and the role of organizations such as yours will be going forward, especially for communities such as Asians, who are now suddenly looked upon differently than they used to be? So what are some of the key changes? And it'll be interesting to see it coming from you, you know, having worked in this space for so long.
So key changes, as in what I see has changed from when I was here to
more to do with what do you think is likely going to change from here on? The way, you know, people are perceived within societies now, like Asians, for example, you and I, we may be looked in a certain way after a big decision, political decision like the Brexit, or what's happening in the US right now. There are political reforms, and they are likely to somehow trickle down into the way we are in societies, or the way we get treated in societies, don't you think?
It would. I wish I had a crystal ball, because this is so complex. It is very difficult. If I kind of could see into the future, if I could forecast, I'd make a fortune. But it's very difficult. I understand what you're saying. It could, for example, what is happening with the Trump, if you just look at it as a model and politically what's happening there. I, for example, didn't anticipate the kind of reaction that has taken place. I didn't anticipate that there would be a president of one of the top country in the world who actually humiliated women. I mean, it just didn't occur to me. I thought that the people of the US would not allow such a person to get the sort of power that he does. And then once he was in power, for example, I thought, okay, they're not going to allow him to continue. But hey, it is. So it is difficult to understand the mass behavior, because there are so many tiny, tiny elements that go to make that behavior.
Okay, in that case, let's flip the coin. You did mention that when you came here in the UK, it wasn't easy for Asians. They weren't easily accepted. So what factored in the change to suddenly change perceptions? I wouldn't use the word suddenly, but over the years, what were some of the key elements or societal changes or social changes that led to acceptance, that led to people being more integrated in society?
In the UK?
In the UK, yes.
It may be quite a few things, actually.
Because you specifically help Asians cope with work pressures here, with trying to settle and integrate in their work environments, you know, it would be nice to hear what are some of the key tools you would equip them with.
Okay. So first of all, there is a small change. It's still not enough and it's not significant from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a change because there are numbers. There are more Asian, more Indians in the UK than I have ever seen, which means that it is absolutely essential wherever, you know, either in society, workplace, institutions, organizations, for people to actually find a way of working with Indians, because we are here. So that is one part of it, and that's why there is a change. The second part of it is, of course, Britain has a history. Their colony, so they've already done some level of work about understanding race.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but as Shashi Tharoor says, they don't teach them in the schooling system.
Yeah.
So the new generation doesn't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. We look back in history and we can assume people know here.
Well, if you look at the history in India too,
yeah.
When I was taught history, I didn't know. I didn't know because. Clive and all the other colonial people.
Yeah, but still talk about freedom fighters. You still know that they're fighting against British. You probably don't know what they, you know, what if there's anything good that British have done.
Yeah.
But they're still, you know, you have Tatya Tope of the world and you have Jallianwala Bagh incident, etc.
Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah.
there are snippets in your history where you can say, okay, there was something bad happened in our country many years ago.
But it was whitewashed. It was whitewashed. They weren't the depth that we are seeing now.
Yeah.
I didn't see when I was being taught. So it's wonderful that all of this information is now becoming public and people, and with, of course, with information being available on the net, it's people can read, people can see exactly.
270 years, but yes, it is kind of making its way.
So, but the other issue then that did come up for a while is we had the influx of Central Europeans and Eastern Europeans who then had to try and understand how Indians and the British work.
Yeah.
And there was quite a trend for about 5 to 10 years where there was huge racial conflict between Indians and Central Europeans because they don't have the history that the British have.
Mm.
So the British can make a more inroad into understanding race than, say, the Central Europeans who have not been exposed to, well, the Germans have to some extent, but if you look at Poland and Slovakia and so on, they don't.
Mm.
They don't have that background.
It's interesting that we're the same people doing our jobs, getting on that tube every morning, but then there has to be one change, and overnight our acceptance, our attitudes towards the person sitting next to us on the tube could just change.
Yeah.
And that's the reason I was trying to kind of get to the bottom of what drives that switch on or off. And also, I think a lot of people forget that apart from the fact that we are heavily trying to integrate ourselves in societies here, and when we say I just class everybody foreign coming into this country, to the UK. And we go through so much personally as well that it's a big load on our systems emotionally, physically. And I don't think that gets highlighted enough.
Absolutely.
So, you know, for example, we live in an environment which is protected. We are eating a certain kind of food. We are, you know, we've grown up a certain way. We're exposed to certain environments. But then we come to countries like off the West, where we get exposed to a totally different, gut flora changes, society changes, pressures change. It takes a toll on our system.
Yeah.
We develop syndromes that, you know, Asians are not known to develop.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on
that? I'm totally in agreement with what you're saying. In fact, I made some notes about this, is that migration takes a heavy toll on people. Again, I should qualify that and say migration where there are massive cultural differences.
Mm.
So, for example, as an Indian, I can only speak about that. Coming to the UK, for example, it's a huge shift. One, you have color, difference in color. Two, you have differences in religion. Three, you have difference in language. We speak English, but the English that we speak in India has very different meaning. Some of the words have a different meaning to the English here. And then there is the customs, the cultural mores, the subtext, the implicit biases. There's a whole range of things that absolutely not to forget the weather, that we really don't recognize and acknowledge, and we should, because it's a huge drain on people. It takes away a lot from energy, and it takes a good amount of time for people to actually understand the new culture.
Hmm.
Yeah, and of course for Indians, we come, I don't know about now, I think it may be a little different, but in my time, I was coming from a developing culture or a developing economy to a developed economy. So again, the implicit understanding was that I'm coming asking for something. So there is a power differential there and you get treated accordingly. So I'm hoping that's changed to some extent now.
Yes.
Let's take back here a bit, the early days in the UK. You obviously had double masters, you did your studies, passed out from LSE, you got in touch with LSE you worked with LSE for quite a bit. What are one of the areas that you've probably learned from those opportunities, and did you manage to get any opportunity to work on a project with India? At all?
As I said, one of the projects that I did work in India was with the CAF, the Charities Aid Foundation. They sponsored a project that I did, which was to assess the viability of setting up CAF in India. So that was one. after that, there wasn't much. I didn't have much to do with Indian organizations post that, because I had children and my focus was more about grounding myself here in Britain, because I moved and I needed to understand, assimilate myself here rather than put a step out.
Right.
So the other difference is that, again, personally, because I'm married to an English person, it means I have a lot of energy that I need to expend to understand that dynamic as well. So it's quite complex. So if I was married to an Indian, I think it would be easy for us to just disappear to India and, maybe work on some projects and so on. But no. So what the LSE has taught me, amazingly, is the strength of politics and how powerful politics is and the political economy is. And really, for me, I think it's an understanding of how powerless the ordinary citizen is to actually reconcile and recognize that, and still not kind of go into a cynical mode and not do anything at all, but to step back and say, okay, this exists and I will try and do what I can in my own little way, because that's what we were talking about earlier, isn't it? There's a big picture that you see and you understand how all of that works.
Mm. Isn't it ironical though, because the biggest political changes happened in the last couple of years have actually been driven by people, the referendum here, and then the election of Trump in the US. So in a way, it is the society telling us something that, you know, it needs to break for something to happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I have the Shift Collective, because I all of us in the team want this momentum. We want organizations to realize. I don't know if you've read Naomi Klein, but that really opens up your eyes to how societies are being managed by large corporations. Mm-hmm. In fact, governments are being managed by large corporations. Mm-hmm. So it's to understand that and then make a way for you to utilize your own skills, either at a personal level or at an organizational level, group level, societal level, in any way you can, really. And if you happen to be in a powerful position, like if you're a politician or somebody who can make changes, then... Yeah. It behooves you to ensure that you have the positive part of society in mind, that you do things so that society progresses.
But do you think, is it always the onus lies within, you know, people in the power? Because end of the day, if they even wants to change something, are people ready for that change? For instance, if they are looking at a broader picture to see we can integrate people from, let's say, Middle Eastern or African, you know, the refugee scenario, etc., if we can integrate them into a certain part of London, for argument's sake, do you think the people are ready for that kind of change, even if it makes sense that, you know, these kind of integration is required for the society so we don't divide the society further? And also things like, like recently, there was an incident with Uber losing the license.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the people have a certain habit. They get... They're very selfish in a way that we need to understand that we are comfortable in our own given space.
Yeah.
If that space is amended or changed in any form or shape, are we as a human being open to change A? Mm. So, you know, we can always put a finger to any powerful corporations or politicians saying, you're not changing the way I want the change to happen.
Mm.
You're changing the way you think is right, which might not be the right way for me.
Yeah. Which is why it is so, so important for change, that is, you're talking about at a mass level, to come from the bottom up. It has to come from, for example, if you want to, you spoke about integration. You can't prescribe a policy or a format to change somebody. You just, it's totally wrong.
Yeah.
It has to come from the person, the group. They have to. They have to put forward their view as to what they want to change, because they know best.
Yeah.
They know best. So all we are doing, or what I would be doing, is facilitating that, offering my skills to help them navigate that path, because it's difficult to change. It's very difficult to change, because we want our comforts. Why would I want to change?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because that was going to be my next question, that who writes these guidelines on... It should be a particular way.
Just the people. The people who want that change to happen. It has to come from the bottom. I mean, again, just going back to my history, both my parents were freedom fighters. So they were both in prison, Yerrawaddy jail, during the colonial time, during the British rule. And my grandmother was involved in this underground movement where she hid all the local plans for activism in the well, you know, the wells.
Yeah.
So I know that it has to come from the people who want the change to happen. It has to come from the people. And it's, I mean, look at what Black Lives Matter has done to the world.
Mm.
It's phenomenal change. And the suffragettes, it's come from the bottom. So what for me is a little bit of a concern is the information that's available. It's very, very difficult for people at the moment to discern what is accurate and what isn't.
Mm.
And then lies the problem going forward. Because who do you believe? Who do you trust?
Yeah.
What do you accept as the truth?
And in some ways, I personally think that when you do equip people with awareness, it's suddenly you empower them to make their own decisions. Because I think coming from your parents, you mentioned were freedom fighters, and if you wouldn't have been aware of all that, if you wouldn't have been aware of the fact that they were involved in this whole struggle, and you still made it to the UK, so you have started that change, and that was your own personal decision and choice.
Yeah.
Whereas someone sitting here, if they wouldn't know about colonialism, and they would just pick a finger at anybody who is not white, then that's in a way to do with, because they don't even know what blacks and whites were, what the history was, and the information. And I think it is now coming out in the public domains. People are now waking up to what really happened. And not just colonialism. We talk about colonialism because we are Asians and we're obsessed with partition. We're obsessed with talking about British rule in India and how much it impacted us. But I think information is key. It is. And again, after that, what happens is up to the person.
Absolutely agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have an issue around Croydon of safety.
Okay.
There's a lot of stabbing. And most of the targets and the perpetrators are young people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm also creative. I'm a whole lot of hats I have. So in my head, I thought, okay, here's the thing. One thing is we need to bring more movement on the streets. So we need more people out there.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we know that art and culture is something that enables people to feel better about their environment.
Mm.
So there are two things there.
Mm.
So what I'm doing now is working with the local council, potentially the police commissioner. So we're going to be bringing in young people.
Mm.
So there are a few youth organizations that are working at helping particularly disenfranchised youth to build confidence and skills and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to try and bring them in because they should be out there on the street developing these art installations. And I have an artist who's going to come and coach and mentor these young people.
Right.
Imagine when young people like that are engaged in their neighborhoods, they wouldn't want to hurt the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I mean about all I'm doing is bringing various bits together and saying, you own this and we'll help you. So these little things actually matter.
I think it's fair to say that for psychologists like Shubha, societal changes are different in demographies like India, and they're different in countries like the UK. And you know, it comes with its own pressures, it comes with its own challenges, and the tools we give to people and individuals, organizations to deal with them will certainly be different.
Mm.
All we can say is that we wish you all the luck, and in this tremendous work that you're doing, I'm sure your wealth of experience and background will play very well into bringing a real shift in society with your Shift Collective. So thanks very much for joining us, Shubha.
Thank you both. It was a pleasure talking to both of you.
Hope you enjoyed listening to this episode. You can catch all upcoming episodes on the website globalize-asian.co.uk or via your iOS or Android devices. Also, if you wish to join us as a speaker and share your story, please do drop us a message via the contact form on the website. That's it for now from Gagan and Vatsala.
Thank you very much, guys, for listening to our podcast. A quick shout out to our supporter for the podcast, Royal Beans. Royal Beans is a premium artisan chocolate brand operating out of the city of Bangalore in India. Currently, they're offering Belgian chocolate bonbons infused with interesting flavors like cappuccino, masala chai, dark chocolate ganache, sea salt caramel, and many more. Just visit their website on royalbeans.in and order for yourself or get it delivered to your loved ones in major cities across India. As a listener of a podcast, you are entitled to get 10% discount on the order value when you use the code GLA10 at the checkout. So go ahead and check it out.